I woke before my alarm and hurried over to the oval mirror in the hall. My image glowed back at me. Even my rumpled pajamas had a certain jaunty look.
This week on Selected Shorts, seeing is believing, and a really precocious child.
You may wonder why we keep that window wide open on an October afternoon, said the niece, indicating a large French window that opened onto a lawn. But it's quite warm for the time of year, said Frampton. But has that window got anything to do with the tragedy? Out through that window, 3 years ago to a day, her husband and her two young brothers went off for their day's shooting. They never came back.
I'm Neil Gaiman, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, a series which brings together the best actors from Broadway and Hollywood to read great literature, old and new, on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. Can we believe our own eyes? The two stories on this program are about perception and delusion. First, Stephen Milhouse's Miracle Polish. Milhouse's work is often just to one side of the real, and in Miracle Polish, he examines how we see ourselves and how we see others. Snow White's evil stepmother asked her magic mirror a question and was never satisfied with the answer. Let's find out what kind of answer we get from Miracle Polish. Miracle Polish is performed by Shorts regular Paul Hecht.
I should have said no to the stranger at the door with his skinny throat and his black sample case that pulled him a little to the side so that one of his jacket cuffs was higher than the other. A polite no would have done the trick. No thanks, I'm afraid not today. And then the closing of the door and the heavy click of the latch. But I'd seen the lines of dirt in the black shoe creases, the worn-down heels, the shine on the jacket sleeves, the glint of desperation in his eyes. All the more reason, I said to myself, to send him on his way as I stepped aside and watched him move into my living room. He looked quickly around before setting his case down on the small table next to the couch. I'd made up my mind to buy something from him, anything, a hairbrush, the Brooklyn Bridge. Buy it and get him out of here. I had better things to do with my time. But there was no hurrying him as he slowly undid each clasp with his bony fingers and explained in a mournful voice that this was my lucky day. In the suddenly opened case, I saw six rows of identical dark brown glass bottles, each a bit smaller than a bottle of cough medicine. Two things struck me. The case must have been very heavy, and he must not have sold anything in a long time. The product was called Miracle Polish. It cleaned mirrors with one easy flick of the wrist. He seemed surprised, even suspicious, when I said I'd take one, as if he'd wandered the earth for years, with the same case filled to bursting with unsold bottles. I tried not to imagine what would drive a man to go from house to house in a neighborhood like this one, with porches and old maples and kids playing basketball in the driveways, a neighborhood where Girl Scouts sold you cookies and the woman across the street asked you to contribute to the leukemia drive. But no strangers with broken-down shoes and desperate eyes came tramping from door to door, lugging heavy cases full of brown bottles called Miracle Polish. The name exasperated me. A child could have done better than that, though there was something to be said for the way it sat there, flaunting its fraudulence. "Don't trust me," it shouted, for all to hear. Don't be a fool. When he tried to sell me a second bottle, he understood from my look that it was time to go. "You've made a wise choice," he said, solemnly glancing at me and looking abruptly away, and then he clicked his case shut and hurried out the door as if afraid I'd change my mind. Lifting a slat of the half-closed blinds, I watched him make his way along the front walk with the sample case pulling him to one side. At the sidewalk, he stopped, put down his case next to the sugar maple, wiped his jacket sleeve across his forehead, and gazed up the block, as if he were the new boy in school, getting ready to cross the schoolyard where faces were already turning to stare at him. For a moment, he looked back at my house, and when he saw me watching him, he grinned suddenly, then frowned and jerked his head away. With a sharp snap, I let the blind slat drop. I had no interest in mirror polish. I placed the bottle in a drawer of the hutch where I kept extra flashlight batteries, packages of light bulbs, and an unused photograph album, and gave no more thought to it. Early one morning, a week or so later, I stepped over to the oval mirror in the upstairs hall, as I did every morning before leaving for work, and as I tugged down the sides of my suit jacket and smoothed my tie, I noticed a small smudge on the glass near my left shoulder. The smudge had probably been there for years, ever since I'd brought the mirror down from my parents' attic, along with a faded armchair and my grandmother's couch with the threadbare arms. I tried to recall whether I had ever cleaned the oval mirror before, whether I had ever bothered to dust the old mahogany frame carved with leaves and flowers. I understood that I was having these thoughts only because of the stranger with the bony fingers and the worn-down heels. And as I went down to the hutch, I felt a burst of irritation as I heard him say, "This is your lucky day." Upstairs, I pulled a tissue from the box in the bathroom and unscrewed the top of the brown bottle. On the dark glass, in white capital letters, stood the words, "Miracle Polish." The liquid was thick and slow and greenish-white. I applied a bit to the tissue and wiped the smudge, and when I lifted my hand, I was almost disappointed to see that the spot was gone. I was aware of another thing. The rest of the mirror looked dull or tarnished. Had I really never noticed it before? With another dab of polish, I set to work wiping the entire surface right up to the curves of the frame. It was done quickly. I stepped back for a look. In the light from the overhead bulb with its old glass shade mixed with sunlight from the window on the nearby landing, I saw myself reflected clearly. But it was more than that. There was a freshness to my image, a kind of mild glow that I'd never seen before. I looked at myself with interest. This in itself was striking, for I wasn't the kind of man who looked at himself in mirrors. I was the kind of man who spent as little time as possible in front of mirrors, the kind of man who had a brisk and practical relation to his reflection, with its tired eyes and its disappointed shoulders, its look of defeat. Now, I was standing before a man who resembled my old reflection almost exactly, but who had been changed in some manner, the way a lawn under a cloudy sky changes when the sun comes out. What I saw was a man who had something to look forward to, a man who expected things of life. That afternoon, when I returned from work, I went up to the oval mirror. In the polished glass, I was struck again by a sense of freshness. Had the mirror really been so deeply in need of cleaning? There were three other mirrors in the house: the mirror over the sink in the upstairs bathroom, the mirror over the sink in the downstairs half bath, and the small circular mirror with a wooden handle that hung on a hook beside the upstairs bathroom window. None of them had seemed in need of cleaning before, but when I was through with them, I saw my new reflection glowing back at me from all three. I looked at the brown bottle of miracle polish in my hand. It seemed an ordinary bottle, a bottle like any other. If the polish had made me look younger, if it had made me handsome, if it had smoothed my skin and fixed my teeth and changed the shape of my nose, I'd have known it was some horrible mechanical trick, and I'd have smashed those mirrors with my fists rather than allow myself to be taken in like a fool. But the image in the mirror was unmistakably me. Not young, not good-looking, not anything in particular. A little slumped, heavy at the waist, pouchy under the eyes. Not the sort of man that anyone would ever choose to be, and yet he looked back at me in a way I hadn't seen for a long time, a way that made the other things all right. He looked back at me, the thought sprang to mind, like a man who believed in things. The next morning, I woke before my alarm and hurried over to the oval mirror in the hall. My image glowed back at me. Even my rumpled pajamas had a certain jaunty look. In the polished glass, the dull walls seemed brighter, the bedroom door a richer brown. In the bathroom mirror, I shone forth. The whiteness of the sink burned in the glass. The towels looked fuller. Downstairs, the reflected window in the half-bath showed part of a brilliant curtain beyond which lay the green grass of childhood summers. All day at work, I thought of nothing but those shining surfaces like coins catching the sun. And when I came home, I went from mirror to mirror, striking poses, turning my head from side to side. Because I prided myself on never having false hopes, on never permitting myself to imagine that things were better than they were, I asked myself whether I might be allowing the mirrors to deceive me. I mean, maybe the greenish-white polish contained a chemical that upon contact with glass produced an optical distortion. Maybe the words, miracle, polish, had caused cells in my brain to fire in a series of associations that affected the way I saw the reflected world. Whatever was happening, I knew that I needed another opinion from someone I could trust. It was Monica who would set me straight. Monica would know. Monica, who looked at the world through large, kind, skeptical eyes, darkened by many disappointments. Monica arrived, as she did, twice a week, after work, once on Tuesdays, and once with her overnight bag on Fridays. And, as always, when I greeted her, I was careful not to look too closely at her, for Monica was likely to draw back and say, "Is something wrong?" while raising her hand anxiously to her hair. She had a habit of assessing her looks mercilessly. As she approved of her eyes, she liked the shape of her wrists and the length of her fingers, put up with her calves, but was unforgiving about her thighs, her chin, her biggish knees, her hips, and her upper arms. She fretted over any imperfection in her skin, like a mosquito bite or a heat rash or a tiny pimple, and she often wore a hidden Band-Aid on a shoulder or calf, holding some ointment in place. She wore long skirts that came down to her ankles with plain blouses over plain white bras. She liked to mix dark greens, dark browns, and dark grays. Her shoulder-length brown hair was usually straight and parted in the middle, though sometimes she pulled it back and gathered it in a big, dark clip that looked like an enormous insect. She inspected herself in front of any mirror, searching for flaws like a teenage girl before a big party. In fact, she was 40 and worked as an administrative assistant at the local high school. For years, we had edged toward each other without moving all the way. I liked how she hesitated a little before easing into a smile. I liked the slight heaviness of her body, its faint awkwardness, its air of mild tiredness. I liked how, when she took off her shoes and placed her feet on the hassock, she would wiggle her toes slowly and say, crinkling her eyes, "That feels really, really good." Sometimes, in a certain light, when she held her body a certain way, I would see her as a woman for whom things had not worked out as she had hoped, a woman sinking slowly into defeat. And then a burst of fellow feeling would come over me, for I knew how difficult it was waiting for something better, waiting for something that was never going to happen. I took her upstairs to the oval mirror and switched on the light. "Look at that," I said, and swept out my arm in a stagey way. It was a gesture meant to imply that what I had to show her was nothing much, really. It was nothing to be taken seriously. I had hoped the reflection in the polished mirror would please her in some way, but I hadn't expected what I saw. For there she was, without a touch of weariness, a fresh Monica, a vibrant Monica, a Monica with a glow of pleasure in her face. She was dressed in clothes that no longer seemed a little drab, a little elderly, but were handsomely understated, seductively restrained. Not for a moment did the mirror make her look young or beautiful, for she was not young and she was not beautiful, but it was as if some inner constriction had dissolved, some sense of her drifting gradually into unhappiness. In the mirror, she gave forth a fine resilience. Monica saw it, I saw her see it, and she began turning her body from side to side, smoothing down her long skirt over her hips, pulling her shoulders back, arranging her hair. Now, in the mornings, I rose with a kind of zest and went directly to the hall mirror, where even my tumbled hair gave me a look of casual confidence, and the shadowy folds under my eyes spoke of someone in the habit of facing and overcoming obstacles. In my cubicle, I worked with concentration and with an odd lightness of heart, and when I returned home in the late afternoon, I looked at myself in all four mirrors. It struck me that before I could reach the oval mirror in the upstairs hall, I had to pass through the front hall, cross the dusky living room with its sagging couch, walk the length of the kitchen, and climb two sets of creaking stairs, the long one up to the landing and the short one up to the hall. One night after dinner, I drove to the outskirts of town, where the old shopping center faced off against the new mall in a battle of slashed prices. And in the aisle after blenders and juicers, I came to them. I saw tall, narrow mirrors, square mirrors framed in oak and dark walnut, round mirrors like gigantic eyeglass lenses, cheval mirrors, mirrors framed in coppered bronze, mirrors with rows of hooks along the bottom. Avoiding my reflections as well as I could, for these mirrors showed only a tired man with a look of sorrow in his eyes, I chose a rectangular mirror with a cherry wood frame. At home, I opened a drawer of the hutch and took out the brown bottle. With a few careful swipes of a cloth, I polished the mirror. I hung it in the front hall across from the closet and next to the boot tray with its old slippers and gardening shoes, and stepped back. In the light of the ceiling bulb, I saw my reflection standing with a cloth over his shoulder and looking out at me as if ready to hurl himself into whatever the day might bring. The sight of him standing there with his sleeves pushed up and his cloth over his shoulder and his look of readiness, all this made me smile. And the smile that came back to me seemed to stream out of the glass and into my arms, my chest, my face, my blood. The next day after work, I stopped at a furniture store and bought another mirror. At home, I polished it and hung it in the kitchen facing the table. As I ate my dinner, I was able to look up whenever I liked and see the oak table, the gleaming plate with its chicken leg and baked potato, the glowing silverware, and my reflection looking up alertly like someone whose attention has been called to an important matter. On Friday, Monica entered the front hall and stopped sharply when she saw the mirror. She glanced at me and seemed about to say something, then turned her face away. In front of the mirror, she stared at herself thoughtfully for a long while. Without turning back to me, she said she supposed it wouldn't be such a bad idea to be able to check her hair and blouse before entering the living room, especially when it was pouring down with rain or when the wind was blowing. I said nothing as I watched her reflection push her hair boldly from her cheek. Together, she and Monica moved toward the edge of the mirror and disappeared into the living room. In the kitchen, I saw Monica's lips pull into a little tight circle. It was an expression I'd never cared for, with its combination of petulance and stubborn severity. But in the new mirror, I saw only a flirtatious pout. "It's just an experiment," I said. "If you really don't like it..." "Oh, but it's your house," she said. "But that isn't the point," I said. She threw me a look and lowered her eyes. It was a way she had of protesting silently. She sat with her back to the mirror as I brewed her a pot of herb tea. Seated across from her, I was able to look beyond her strained face to the back of her head, the back of her blouse collar showing through her hair, the top of her shoulder blades. They all seemed to be enjoying themselves as she talked to me about her troubles with the lawn man. Once, when she turned to look out the window, I saw in the mirror the curved line of her forehead, the upward slant of the bottom of her nose, the little slope between her nostrils and her upper lip, and I was struck by the fine liveliness of her profile. I let a day pass by, but the next day, I bought a large, dark-framed mirror for the living room and hung it across from the couch. I took out my brown bottle and polished the mirror well, and when I stepped back, I admired the new room that sprang into view in the polished depths. Monica would, of course, push her lips together, but she would come to see it was all for the best. The mirrors of my house filled me with such a sense of gladness that a room without one struck me as a dark cell. I brought home a full-length mirror for the TV room, a rectangular mirror with a simple frame for the upstairs bedroom, an identical one for the guest room down the hall. At a yard sale, I bought an old shield-shaped mirror that I hung in the cellar behind the washer and dryer. And one evening when I entered the kitchen, a restlessness seized me, and when I returned from the mall, I hung a second mirror in the kitchen between the two windows. Monica said nothing. I could feel her opposition hardening in her like a muscle. I wasn't unaware that I was behaving oddly, like a man in the grip of an obsession. At the same time, what I was doing felt entirely natural and necessary. Some people added windows to brighten their homes. I bought mirrors. Was it such a bad thing? I kept seeing them at yard sales, leaning against rickety tables piled with pink dishes or hanging in hallways and bedrooms at estate sales at the fancy end of town. I added a second one to the living room, a third to the upstairs bath. In the front hall, on the back of the front door, I hung a mirror framed in a dark wood that matched the color of the umbrella stand. And when I passed by my mirrors, when I caught even a glimpse of myself as I walked into a room, I felt a surge of well-being. What was the harm? Now and then, Monica tried to be playful about it all. "Watch," she would say, "only one mirror in the landing." And then her expression would change as she saw me sinking into thought. Once she said, "You know, sometimes I think you like me better there," she pointed to a mirror, "than here." She pointed to herself. She said it teasingly with a little laugh, but in her look was an anxious question. As if to prove her wrong, I turned my full attention to her. Before me, I saw a woman with a worried forehead and unhappy eyes. I imagined her gazing out at me from all the mirrors of my house with eyes serene and full of hope. And an impatience came over me as I looked at her dark brown sweater, at the hand nervously smoothing her dark green skirt, at the lines of tension in her mouth. In order to demonstrate to Monica that all was well between us, that nothing had changed, that I was no slave to the mirrors, I proposed a Saturday picnic, and we packed a lunch in a basket and took a long drive out to the lake. Monica had put on a big-brimmed straw hat that I'd never seen before and a new light green blouse with a little shimmer in it. In the car, she took off her hat and placed it on her lap as she sat back with half-closed eyes and let the sunlight ripple over her face. A tiny green jewel sparkled in her earlobe. At the picnic grounds, we sat at one of the sunny and shady tables scattered under the high pines that grew at the edge of a small beach. It was a hot, drowsy day. The smoke of grills rose into the branches. A man stood with one foot on his picnic table bench, an arm resting on his thigh as he held a can of beer and stared out at the beach and the water. Kids ran among the tables on the beach. Three boys in knee-length bathing trunks were playing catch with enormous baseball gloves and a lime-green tennis ball. A plump mother and her gaunt teenage son were hitting a volleyball back and forth. Young women in bikinis and men with white hair on their chests strolled on the sand. In the water, a few people were splashing and laughing. A black dog with tall ears was swimming toward shore with a wet stick in its mouth. And farther out, you could see canoes moving and oars lifting with sun flashes of spray. And when I turned to Monica, I saw the whole afternoon flowing into her face and eyes. And after the picnic, we walked along a trail that led partway around the lake. Here and there, on narrow strips of sand at the lake edge, people lay on their backs on towels in the sun. We made our way down to the shore through prickly bushes. On the sand, Monica pulled off her sandals, and lifting up her long skirt, she stepped into the water and threw back her head to take in the sun with closed eyes. At that moment, it seemed to me that everything was possible for Monica and me. And going up to her, I said, "I've never seen you like this." With her eyes still closed, she said, "I'm not myself today." She began to laugh. And then I began to laugh because of what we both had said and because of her laughter and the sun and the sky and the lake. On the ride home, she fell asleep with her head against my shoulder. The long outing had tired me too, though not in the same way. In the course of the afternoon, an uneasiness had begun to creep into me. The glare of the sun on the water hurt my eyes. The heat pressed down on me. There was a slowness in things, a sluggishness. Monica seemed to walk with more effort, as if the air were a hot heaviness she was pushing her way through. The two of us, she in her straw hat and I in my cargo shorts, seemed to me actors playing the part of ordinary people enjoying a day at the lake. In fact, I was a man weighed down with disappointment, a man for whom things hadn't worked out the way he had once imagined, a quiet man, cautious in his life, timid when he came right down to it, though content enough to drift along through the little rituals of his day. And Monica? I glanced over at her. The back of her hand lay on her leg. The four fingers were leaning to one side. The thumb hung in front of them. And something about those fingers and that thumb seemed to me the shape of despair. But when I opened my front door and stepped into the hall behind Monica, then the good feeling returned. In the mirror, we stood there, she in her shimmering green blouse and I with a glow of sunburn on my face. Deep in the shine of the polished glass, her hand rose in a graceful arc to remove her straw hat. In the living room, I snatched glimpses of her in both mirrors as she walked buoyantly toward the kitchen. In the sunny kitchen, her cheerful reflection picked up a pitcher of water that caught the light. I looked at the second mirror, where she began to raise a glass of shining water, paused suddenly, and opened her mouth in a lusty yawn. "I'd like to lie down," Monica said. I turned my head and saw her tight lips and tired eyelids. I followed her as she made her way slowly up the stairs and past the new mirror on the landing. For a moment, her hair glowed at me from the glass. At the top of the stairs, she walked sternly and without a glance past the oval mirror and into the bedroom, where I watched her bright reflection lie down on the bed and close her eyes. I, too, was tired. I was more than tired, but the sheer pleasure of being home filled me with a restless energy that drove me to stride through all the rooms of the house. From time to time, I stopped before a polished mirror to turn my head this way and that. It was as if my house, with its many mirrors, drew all the old heaviness and weariness from my body, and in a sudden burst of inspiration, I took out the bottle of Miracle Polish, which was still two-thirds full, and went down to the cellar where I applied it to a new mirror that had been leaning against the side of the washing machine, waiting for me to decide where to hang it. Later that evening, as we sat in the living room, Monica still seemed tired and a little moody. I had led her to the couch and tried to position her so that she could see her good-humored reflection, but she refused to look at herself. I could feel resistance coming out of her like the push of a hand. In the mirror, I admired a shoulder of her blouse. And then I glanced over at the other Monica, the one sitting stiffly and very quietly on the couch. I had the sense of a sky darkening before a storm. "Cat," I thought I heard her say so softly that I wondered if she had spoken at all, or perhaps she had said, "Can." What did you? I breathed out, barely able to hear my own words. "I can't," she said, and now there was no mistaking it. Such a perfect day. And now this. She raised her arm in a weary, sweeping motion that seemed to include the entire room, the entire universe. In the mirror, her reflection playfully swept out her arm. "I can't," I tried. "But I can't. I tried, but I can't. I can't. You'll have to choose." "Choose?" Her answer was so hushed that it seemed barely more than an exhalation of air. "Between me and her." "You mean her?" "I hate her," she whispered and burst into tears. She immediately stopped, took a deep breath, and burst into tears again. "You don't look at me," she said. "But that's not," I said. "I have to go," she said, and she stood up. She was no longer crying. She took another deep breath and rubbed her nostrils with the back of a bent finger. She reached into a pocket of her skirt and pulled out a tissue that crumbled into fuzz. "Here," I said, holding out my handkerchief. She hesitated, took it from me, and dabbed her nostrils. She handed back the handkerchief. She looked at me and turned to leave. "Don't," I said. "Me or her," she whispered, and was out the door. During the next week, I flung myself into my work, which was just complicated enough to require my full attention without interesting me in the least. At 5 o'clock, I came directly home, where I felt soothed in every room. But I was no child. I was no naive self-deceiver intent on evading a predicament. I wanted to understand things. I wanted to make up my mind. From the beginning, there had been a deep kinship between Monica and me. She was wary, trained to expect little of life, grateful for small pleasures, on her guard against promises, accustomed to making the best of things, in the habit of both wanting and not daring to want something more. Now, Miracle Polish had come along, with its air of swagger and its taunting little whisper. Why not, it seemed to say. Why on earth not? But the mirrors that strengthened me, that filled me with new life, made Monica bristle. Did she feel that I preferred a false version of her? A glittering version to the flesh and blood Monica with her band-aids and big knees and burden of sorrows? What drew me was exactly the opposite. In the shining mirrors, I saw the true Monica, the hidden Monica, the Monica buried beneath years of discouragement. Far from escaping into a world of polished illusions, I was able to see in the depths of those mirrors the world no longer darkened by diminishing hopes and faded dreams. There, all was clear. There, all was possible. Monica, I understood perfectly, would never see things as I did. When she looked in the mirrors, she saw only a place that kept pulling me away from her, and in that place a rival of whom she was desperately jealous. I felt myself moving slowly in the direction of a dangerous decision I did not wish to make, like someone swerving on an icy road toward an embankment. It wasn't until another week had passed that I knew what I was going to do. Summer was in its fullness. On front porches, neighbors fanned themselves with folded newspapers. Sprinklers sent arcs of spray onto patches of lawn and strips of driveway, which shone in the sun like black licorice. At the top of a ladder, a man in a baseball cap moved a paintbrush lazily back and forth. It was Saturday afternoon. I'd called Monica that morning and told her I had something important to show her. She was to meet me on the front porch. We sat there, drinking lemonade like an old married couple, watching the kids passing on bicycles, a squirrel scampering along a telephone wire, a robin was pecking furiously at the roadside grass, and after a while I said, "Let's go inside." She turned to me then as if she were about to ask a question. "If that's what you want," she finally said, and turned both hands palm up. When we stepped into the front hall, Monica stopped. She stopped so abruptly that it was as if someone had put a heavy hand on her shoulder. I watched her stare at the place where the mirror had hung. She looked at me and looked again at the wall, and then she turned and looked at the back of the front door. Its dark panels shone dully under the hall light. Monica reached out and touched her fingers to my arm. I took her through every room of the house, stopping before familiar walls. In the living room, a photograph of my parents looked out at us from the wall where one mirror had hung. The other place was bare, except for two small holes in the faded wallpaper with its pattern of tall vases filled with pale flowers. In the kitchen, a new poster showed many kinds of tea. In place of the oval mirror in the upstairs hall, there was a framed painting of an old mill beside a brown pond with two ducks. New bathroom cabinets with beveled edged mirrors hung over the upstairs and downstairs sinks. I could see the gratitude rushing into Monica's cheeks. And when the tour was over, I led her to the drawer in the hutch. I removed the brown bottle. In the kitchen, she watched me pour the thick, greenish-white liquid into the sink. I washed out the empty bottle and dropped it into the garbage pail next to the stove. She turned to me and said, "This is the most wonderful gift that you..." "We're not done yet," I said, with a touch of excitement in my voice, and led her through the kitchen door and down the four wooden steps into the backyard. Against the back of the house, all the mirrors stood lined up, slanted at different angles. There it was, the oval mirror from the upstairs hall, leaning over a cellar window, There they were, the two front hall mirrors, the kitchen mirrors in their wooden frames, the shield-shaped mirror from the cellar, the living room mirrors, the bedroom mirrors, the full-length mirror from the TV room, a pair of guest room mirrors, the upstairs bathroom mirror removed from its cabinet, the mirror from the landing, the downstairs bathroom mirror, and other mirrors that I had bought and polished and stored in closets ready to be hung. Square mirrors and round mirrors, swivel mirrors on wooden stands, a mirror shaped like a four-leaf clover. And the bright sun, the polished mirrors, gleamed like jewels. "Here they are," I said, throwing out my hand. I began walking along in front of them from one end to the other. As I passed from mirror to mirror, slanted against the house, I could see different parts of me, my shoes and paint cuffs, my belt and the bottom of my shirt, my sudden whole shape in the tall mirror, my swinging hand. Now and then I caught pieces of Monica's rival standing back on the green, green grass. "And now," I said, as if I was addressing a crowd, and I paused for dramatic effect. I glanced at Monica, who stood there with a look that was difficult to fathom, a worried look, it seemed to me, and I wanted to assure her that there was nothing to worry about. I was doing it all for her. Everything would soon be fine. I bent over behind a broad mirror at the end of the row and withdrew a hammer. And raising the hammer high, I swung it against the glass, and then I walked back along that row of mirrors, swinging the hammer and sending bright spikes of glass into the summer air. "There," I cried, and smashed another. "See," I shouted. I swung, I smashed. Lines of wetness ran along my face. Bits of mirror clung to my shirt. It was over faster than I'd thought possible. All along the back of the house, broken mirror glass lay glittering on the grass. Here and there, an empty frame showed triangles of glass still clinging to the wood. I looked at the hammer in my hand. Suddenly, I threw it across the yard, hurled it high into the row of spruces at the back. I could hear the hammer falling slowly through the needy, needly branches. "There," I said to Monica, and I made a wiping gesture with both hands, the way you do when you're done with something. Then I began walking up and down in front of her. A terrible excitement burned in me. I could feel my blood beating in my neck. I imagine it bursting through the skin in brilliant gushes of red. "She's gone. That's what you wanted, isn't it? Isn't it? All gone. Bye-bye. Are you happy now? Are you?" I stopped in front of her. "Are you? Are you?" I bent close. "Are you? Are you? Are you?" I bent closer still. I bent so close that I couldn't see her anymore. "Are you? Are you? Are you? Are you? Are you?" Monica did the only thing she could do. She fled. But first she stood there as if she were about to speak. She stared at me with the look of a woman who has been struck repeatedly across the face. There was hurt in that look, and tiredness, and a sort of pained tenderness. And along with it all came a quiet sureness as of someone who has made up her mind. And then she turned and walked away. There is a restlessness so terrible that you can no longer bear to sit still in your house. You walk from room to room like someone visiting a deserted town. Every day I mourned for my mirrors with their gleam of miracle polish. Where they'd once hung, I saw only patterns in wallpaper, framed paintings, door panels, lines of dust. One day, I drove out to the mall and came home with an oval mirror in a plain dark frame, which I hung in the upstairs hall. I used it strictly for checking my suit jacket. Once, when the doorbell rang, I rushed downstairs to the front door, but it was only a boy with a jar collecting money for a new scout troop. I could feel grayness sifting down on me like dust. A bottle of miracle polish? Was it so much to ask? One of these days, the stranger is bound to come again. He'll walk toward my house with his heavy case tugging him to one side in my living room. He'll snap open the clasps and show me the brown bottles, row on row. Mournfully, he'll tell me that it's my lucky day. In a voice that is calm but decisive and self-assured, I'll tell him that I want every bottle, every last one. When I close my eyes, I can see the look of suspicion on his face, along with a touch of slyness, a shadow of contempt, and the beginnings of unbearable hope.
Paul Hecht read Stephen Milhouse's Miracle Polish. I'm Neil Gaiman. After a brief break, the English writer Saki goes a little bit too far. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Neil Gaiman. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts, and please write and tell us what you think of today's program. The Edwardian writer, H.H. Munro, who wrote under the pen name Saki, is a favorite of ours. And we featured a number of his stories of preposterous goings-on in high society. This time, it's the open window. Saki as a writer moved very easily and comfortably between humor and real darkness, sometimes edging over into full-on horror. This is one of my favorite of his short stories. It could be a ghost story, or perhaps it's just about the engines that drive some of us to write fiction. The Open Window is performed by the stage and television actor Tandy Cronin. Listen closely for one of the great last lines in comedic fiction.
"My aunt will be down presently, Mr. Nuttall," said a very self-possessed young lady of 15. "In the meantime, you must try and put up with me." Frampton Nuttall endeavoured to say the correct something which should duly flatter the niece of the moment, without unduly discounting the aunt that was to come. Privately, he doubted more than ever whether these formal visits on a succession of total strangers would do much towards helping the nerve cure which he was supposed to be undergoing. "I know how it will be," his sister had said, when he was preparing to migrate to this rural retreat. "You will bury yourself down there and not speak to a living soul, and your nerves will be worse than ever from moping. I shall just give you letters of introduction to all the people I know there. Some of them, as far as I can remember, were quite nice." Frampton wondered whether Mrs. Sappleton, the lady to whom he was presenting one of the letters of introduction, came into the nice division. "Do you know many of the people round here?" asked the niece, when she judged that they had had sufficient silent communion. "Hardly a soul," said Frampton. "My sister was staying here at the rectory, you know, some 4 years ago, and she gave me letters of introduction to some of the people here." He made the last statement in a tone of distinct regret. "Then you know practically nothing about my aunt," pursued the self-possessed young lady. "Only her name and address," admitted the caller. He was wondering whether Mrs. Sappleton was in the married or widowed state. An undefinable something about the room seemed to suggest masculine habitation. "Her great tragedy happened just 3 years ago," said the child. "That would be since your sister's time." "Her tragedy?" asked Frampton. Somehow in this restful country spot, tragedy seemed out of place. "You may wonder why we keep that window wide open on an October afternoon," said the niece, indicating a large French window that opened onto a lawn. "It is quite warm for the time of year," said Frampton. "But has that window got anything to do with the tragedy?" "Out through that window, 3 years ago to a day, her husband and her two young brothers went off for their day's shooting. They never came back. In crossing the moor to their favorite snipe shooting ground, they were all three engulfed in a treacherous piece of bog. It had been that dreadful wet summer, you know, and places that were safe in other years gave way suddenly without warning. Their bodies were never recovered. That was the dreadful part of it." Here the child's voice lost its self-possessed note and became falteringly human. "Poor aunt always thinks that they will come back someday, and they and the little brown spaniel that was lost with them, and walk in at that window just as they used to do. That is why the window is kept open every evening till it is quite dusk. Poor dear aunt. She's often told me how they went out. Her husband with his white waterproof coat over his arm, and Ronnie, her youngest brother, singing 'Bertie, why do you bound?' as he always did to tease her, because she said it got on her nerves. Do you know? Sometimes on still, quiet evenings like this, I almost get a creepy feeling that they will all walk in through that window." She broke off with a little shudder. It was a relief to Frampton when the aunt bustled into the room with a whirl of apologies for being later in making her appearance. "I hope Vera has been amusing you," she said. "She's been very interesting," said Frampton. "I hope you don't mind the open window," said Mrs. Sappleton briskly. "My husband and brothers will be home directly from shooting, and they always come in this way. They've been out for snipe in the marshes today, so they'll make a fine mess over my poor carpets. So like you menfolk, isn't it?" She rattled on cheerfully about the shooting and the scarcity of birds and the prospects for duck in the winter. To Frampton, it was all purely horrible. He made a desperate but only partially successful effort to turn the talk onto a less ghastly topic. He was conscious that his hostess was giving him only a fragment of her attention, and her eyes were constantly straying past him to the open window and the lawn beyond. It was certainly an unfortunate coincidence that he should have paid his visit on this tragic anniversary. "The doctors agree in ordering me complete rest, an absence of mental excitement, and avoidance of anything in the nature of violent physical exercise," announced Frampton, who labored under the tolerably widespread delusion that total strangers and chance acquaintances are hungry for the least detail of one's ailments and infirmities, their cause and cure. "On the matter of diet, they are not so much in agreement," he continued. "No," said Mrs. Sappleton, in a voice which only replaced a yawn at the last moment. Then she suddenly brightened into alert attention, but not to what Frampton was saying. "Here they are at last," she cried. "Just in time for tea, and don't they look as if they were muddy up to the eyes?" Frampton shivered slightly and turned towards the niece with a look intended to convey sympathetic comprehension. The child was staring out through the open window with dazed horror in her eyes. In a chill shock of nameless fear, Frampton swung round in his seat and looked in the same direction. In the deepening twilight, three figures were walking across the lawn towards the window. They all carried guns under their arms, and one of them was additionally burdened with a white coat hung over his shoulders. A tired brown spaniel kept close at their heels. Noiselessly, they neared the house. And then a hoarse young voice chanted out of the dusk, "I said, Bertie, why do you bound?" Frampton grabbed wildly at his stick and hat. The hall door, the gravel drive, and the front gate were dimly noted stages in his headlong retreat. A cyclist coming along the road had to run into the hedge to avoid imminent collision. "Here we are, my dear," said the bearer of the white Macintosh, coming in through the window. "Fairly muddy, but most of it's dry. Who was that who bolted out as we came up?" "A most extraordinary man, a Mr. Nuttall," said Mrs. Sappleton. "Could only talk about his illnesses, and dashed off without a word of goodbye or apology when you arrived. One would think he had seen a ghost." "I expect it was the spaniel," said the niece calmly. "He told me he had a horror of dogs. He was once hunted into a cemetery somewhere on the banks of the Ganges by a pack of pariah dogs and had to spend the night in a newly dug grave with the creatures snarling and grinning and foaming just above him, enough to make anyone lose their nerve. Romance at short notice was her specialty."
That was Tandy Cronin performing The Open Window by Saki. Isn't that a beautiful story? So sharp, so funny, so spooky, and then it reverses on itself delightfully. I'm Neil Gaiman. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, Wanting More, with performances by Fionnuala Flanagan and Jane Kaczmarek. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deardorff Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Perotta. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the short story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trusts Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.